members, while House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy would name five. Pelosi's office said she was considering picking a Republican among her eight appointees. A month ago, Senate Republicans blocked a proposal to form an independent bipartisan commission to investigate the riot. The commission would have been modeled on the one that investigated the 9/11 terrorist attack. Pelosi said in a statement on Monday that Democrats, quote, are determined to find the truth. It's another hot day in D.C. at 93 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, it's 92 degrees and also partly cloudy. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering.
And the previous program was Gays Against Guns, Radio Gag, heard Tuesdays at 2:30 p.m. Stay tuned for Black Star News with Milton Alamadi. This is WBAI New York, 99.5 FM and WBAI.org online. Stay tuned.
Sisters and brothers, welcome to Black Star News Show on WBAI New York 99.5 FM radio. I am your host, Milton Alamadi. Today we're going to be in conversation with the author of a collection of short stories, Walking on Curry Shells, and she will explain the meaning of the title to us as well. Newly published by Grey Wolf Press, available in bookstores and, of course, on Amazon. The author is Nana Nkweti. She's a Cameroonian-American writer, an AKO Kane Prize finalist, an Iowa Writers' Workshop graduate, and the recipient of fellowships from McDowell, Cambilio, UCross, Clarion West, and others. Her writings have appeared in several publications, including Brittle Paper, New Orleans Review, and The Baffler. She's a professor of English at the University of Alabama. She teaches fiction and special topic courses that explore her eclectic literary interests, ranging from graphic novels to medical humanities and on to Afrofuturism. Welcome to Black Star News Show, Nana Nkweti.
Thank you so much for having me, Milton. This is such an honor and a pleasure to be reunited with my New York fam, even if it's via radio.
Okay, very good. And joining me today to conduct this conversation is another writer, Nana Ekua Brew-Hammond. She's a Ghanaian-American author who enjoys digging up histories and truths and connecting them into treasured books for children and adults. And maybe she'll also talk a little bit about her writing as she helps me conduct this conversation. Welcome to Black Star News Show, Nana Ekua Brew-Hammond.
Thank you.
All right, so why don't we get started? Nana Nkweti, I knew you years ago when you were at Medgar Evers College and the African magazine. Now, I had no idea that late at night you were working on these collection of short stories. So please reveal, how long have you been working on this collection? Number one. And then number two, I would like you to say something to inspire other writers that are working at other Medgar Evers around the United States.
Well, I've been writing since I was about 9 years old. I was a young, very kind of like introverted literary kid who was always reading. My imaginary friends were Lizzie Bennet in Pride and Prejudice. I was very geeky as well. I was writing Star Wars fan fiction back in the day before they even had like little black girls in those spaces. So this is one of those things that it's been true to my personality and who I wanted to be. But, you know, being a good immigrant African daughter, we don't necessarily privilege those literary interests. You know, my I thought I had to be a lawyer, doctor, or engineer. So I did. I went that route. I went to nursing school before I even went to college as a way and a means to go to medical school later on. I realized that I was good at nursing, but decided to kind of split the baby and say, hey, maybe I'll do international law because I'm also good at words and I always have been. So when you met me, I was privileging that writing part of my life, but not necessarily privileging the authorial part of my life. So I'd always been writing, always been taking these creative writing classes. New York is very fertile space for you to be taking. After you can work your work day and take some workshop classes in the evening, and many people do so. And so when you met me, I was at the African Magazine, and that was the most I'd ever done to actually say, hey, I want to write full time. But even working at the African, I was not fully invested in writing my fiction yet. And these stories had been percolating in my mind. One of the stories in the collection, The Statistician's Wife, actually, I learned about the story about nurses who were being killed by husbands who were, the gender roles had changed in their marriages. And I was I learned about that through the African Magazine, because the African Magazine was focused on covering what was happening with, people from our background who were living in the diaspora and trying to make a way in this, brave new American world and figuring out what life meant when you're trying to, uphold traditions from back home, but also trying to make a new way for yourself here. So that was one of the things that I learned while I was there. I had access to so many interesting tales from the diaspora. And it started making me want to investigate and write about them, even in my fiction, and explore that in that way. I still didn't privilege writing full time until I was just okay, my family, my siblings, I brought them all here for college. They all are settled in their lives. They've all got their education. And, now I can finally say, hey, I can work, I can work on writing this so-called quote-unquote job that I wasn't really privileging before, and my family's going to be okay. So that's when I finally started doing that. I've been writing since I was a child. I think some of the stories in that book are up to 10 years old. And some of the things that brought me to write them, maybe even older, but you have to kind of make a decision that, hey, I'm going to do this full time.
Yeah, talk a little bit about making that decision, actually. I mean, was there a possibility that you would not have made that decision and never become a full-time writer? Or was it so compelling that maybe even later, if not sooner, you would have ended up being a full-time writer?
Do I want to say that I was a wonderful worker bee, or do I want to say that I was an artist who privileged that creative space and told stories that only I could tell? And I think sometimes you're out there in the world and you're waiting for other people to tell your stories, and you're just like, hey, somebody else is going to do it. I particularly wanted to tell stories about hyphenated Africans who had cultural, this cultural melange and this cultural métissage going on. And I would, I would just be waiting and waiting. And I think Nana Akua Buhamin, wrote a story, Ghanaian Brits, and we have that kind of nice melange. And I was waiting for somebody to do some more around that in the American, hyphenated American African space. And I think a lot of what I was seeing a lot at the time was that, we'd get a lot of really wonderful stories from the continent, or we get a lot of really wonderful stories, but people who had similar backgrounds to myself, having grown up here, but they would often space center their stories in the continent as well. And I just wanted to kind of tell more stories about us living here in America and what that looks like, so when you're waiting for that, you're waiting for somebody else to do it, and you're thinking, hey, I have all these responsibilities as this, immigrant daughter, first generation American, I want to make sure that my family's taken care of. You don't necessarily make that change, privilege that until you really have to. And this is my dream. I've always wanted to do this. My family's taken care of. What is keeping me from doing this now? My family's good. I literally made sure all my siblings brought them back from Africa to go to college. worked as a nurse out all throughout my college life and made sure that they had an apartment to live in and that they all got their education. So what was keeping me again? What was stopping me from doing this again? And then I finally had to say nothing. So, and privilege this.
Lucky us. Okay, over to you, Nana Ikua.
That is such an admirable thing that you did, just, you know, making sure like all of your siblings were taken care of. So kudos to you. And I'm glad that you're able to, you know, you feel that you're at the time in your life when you are privileging yourself and privileging your work. Because I think that this was such such a bold and fresh collection of work. So thank you for it. One of the things that you said made me think about, you know, when you were just talking about the fact that a lot of the, you know, African literature that is coming out is really focused on what's happening on the continent versus the sort of very specific hyphenated experience that we have as like first gen or second gen, whether we're American, European, et cetera. And it's funny because I had a conversation with someone years ago, another writer, where he was saying to me that he actually felt it was really frustrating that a lot of the African literature was coming out focused on the African experience in America or in the UK. And so he was challenging me. He was like, can you write a story that's like fully set on the continent? And would that kind of story even sell? And it's something that has stuck with me like since like 2012. So it's interesting that you mentioned that. But in any event, like I said, I really enjoyed your collection and the nuances that you brought to the experience. I'm thinking of the story in which you sort of juxtapose very cleverly this whole model minority idea between, I think it was the rain check at Momocon, where it's between Astrid and Young. And yes, you sort of like play with this model minority idea of like, you know, the African who is like expected to follow this really like sort of strict, very sort of safe path. And then you have the Korean American who's also facing the same pressure and the camaraderie they share because of that. And I would love it if you talk a little bit about that, because I found that so such a cool way to kind of highlight that pressure that we feel as first gens.
Yeah. So there's something like I want to unpack real quick. It's interesting that your friend like was talking to you about so many stories being based in America. I would love to see those stories. You know, like I feel like, you know, the grass always seems greener, because I know a lot of the stories that I felt were breaking through at that time that I finally said, oh, I'm going to write, were always stories of, they were based on the continent and really important stories to tell, but they privileged a certain type of narrative, like the stories that really, you know, got the most love and bluster. I think I had gone at that time, there was a young man who wrote a story about warlords and being a child soldier. And then, you know, of course, like, you know, stories about war. And I felt that that was at that time, like the constant narrative that I was being given. And I was like, oh, those are the stories that, of course, that need to be told. They're important. They're crucial. But I feel like, you know, as I would often say, like, you know, I lived in Africa for 4 years and I never met a warlord, you know, and I went to prom. And why is that the only type of like, you know, trauma, like they call it trauma porn type of narrative that I'm being given from the continent? Of course, like, you know, what we're seeing in the West is just a microcosm, like a sliver of like the very robust African literary scene that's happening on the ground. So I'm sure that there's, you know, when I go back now and I'm looking at like literature and I'm reading not just what I read here, but I'm also reading things on the from African literary journals, you know, you see so much more of a range. So but I definitely felt like at that time when I was like, I wasn't really seeing enough of like me, like what's this happening? Maybe the stories were coming from us, but not necessarily about our experiences here. anyway, that was what I'm just thinking about that. Like, you know, I would love to actually see more, you know, hyphenated stories, and I'm looking for them. So hit me up with some, like, you know, some recommendations, you know. The idea of that model minority, it was something that I always, you know, I didn't necessarily know I was going to be doing that juxtaposition. I think, you know, as you know, as a writer, these things happen very kind of intuitively. They just happen on impulse. You know, I knew I was going to write about Comic-Con. I knew I was going to write about geek culture. And I wasn't necessarily setting out to say, hey, I'm going to have this young girl be, this is going to be a Kunstlerroman, the story of a young artist becoming. I just knew that I was going to, that some of these things, of course, they're going to naturally start to emerge because we're talking about a young girl who wants to be a graphic novel writer, right? And how can she privilege that? As you heard from my own story, like, you know, maybe this is something that, you know, percolates. And I think, and a lot of like kids of immigrants and, you know, we come here with the striver mentality and it's important, right? We do, you know, there's nothing wrong with it. And it's not to say that, you know, going to Princeton as she has that opportunity to do in that story, or, you know, becoming lawyers and doctors and engineers as we often do, you know, there's nothing wrong with that, right? But the fact that we don't necessarily even privilege that idea of another American dream because our parents' idea of an American dream is so ingrained in us, that's what I'm kind of interrogating and looking at in that story, right? Like that our parents had the opportunity of a lifetime to come here, they felt, and they wanted to, this is the way that they you know, the avenues towards success that they felt were, you know, pre-prescribed for them, right? Another generation comes about and there are other avenues for success and other avenues that maybe not as, you know, as tried and true, but they are there. And I think that that's the interesting kind of tension that is held, like, you know, and when we have like another, you know, I felt like I definitely have always felt a kinship with other third culture kids and other third culture writers, like, you know, Desi writers like Jhumpa Lahiri, ABC writers, American-born Chinese writers like Amy Tan and Lan Samantha Chang and so many others, you know, telling those stories of people who are Desi and ABC, Nisei, Issei, Japanese first and second generation, Caribbean Americans, because we all kind of get that idea of trying to be what our parents did, you know, to be, have an opportunity in this country, but also wanting something else, trying to figure out something else for ourselves, what our dream looks like. We don't necessarily have all the freedom that, like, you know, like just running around here, like, hey, the world is my oyster, that, let's say, I don't even know any black person or any person of color necessarily feels that kind of like white privilege type of like freedom. But we definitely feel like, you know, we have more opportunities, you know, perhaps than our parents did coming here and not necessarily being in Wisconsin's culture. They had to go through a whole process of learning the culture, learning the ways that, but this is our culture, right? This is, we know the space and we're trying to figure out like that knowledge, what can that allow us to do? But then you're also thinking, oh, I still want to make my parents proud. And that's where that whole kind of model minority, oh, let's, you know, my parents pull themselves up by their bootstraps. Do I need to do that as well? Do I need to do exact, you know, do what they did that was just tried and true to be successful in this country? So those tensions are, you know, very across the board. I think when I had a lot of third, I still have a lot of third culture kid friends, and, you know, like whether my friends are, you know, growing up in New Jersey and Rutgers, going to school, it's college in New Jersey, and like Edison was like mini India, all my Pakistani and my Indian friends. And they were just like, yes, we feel that pressure. And then, you know, have your Asian friends. Yes, we feel that pressure. So it would be the same thing, like, you know, the same thing, like, you know, and we felt it. We had to figure it out for ourselves. Like, what does that look like in terms of our generation, in terms of us making choices for ourselves? And, you know, like I said, some of us did become lawyers. doctors, and, you know, it is what it is, you know, it happens, and then you privilege it, like, later on, you're like, oh, well, you know, I didn't go to law school, but now I can finally write that book, you know. Sometimes it happens that way, so.
So, listeners, you've now heard this wonderful conversation we've been having with our guest, Nandan Kweti, the author of Walking on Cowrie Shells, and joining me today in the conversation is Nanaikua Bruhamond, who is also an author. and we'll be discussing her books in a future conversation. Today, we're looking at Nana Nkweti's writing. You've heard a sampling of her reading from the book. And I must tell you, and this is without any bias, it's a book that I enjoy tremendously in reading it for preparation for today's conversation. And the publisher, Grey Wolf, has contributed two copies. And we will send a copy to two of the highest bidders. In that way, we'll be able to raise some money to help support WBAI and its programming. So if you're able to dig a little deeper today, please do call 212-209-2950 and tell us what you're contributing for a copy of Walking on Cowrie Shells. And at the end of the day, we will see who the two highest bidders are. And as I said earlier, that does not mean the rest of you cannot just call and offer your regular contribution to support WBAI. And you can also do so by dialing 212-209-2950. And then, of course, you can adopt one of our shows, one of our programs. And as always, I hope Black Star News Show is one of the programs you decide to adopt as a buddy, in which case the money is taken out of your credit or debit card on a monthly basis. You can do so by going to give, and then the number 2, and then WBAI.org. Now back to our conversation about books.
Yeah, for sure. I think I love, there were so many good lines. I think you talked about the sort of like the triumvirate of jobs that, like, you know, would be respected in our community. And I think you talked about, like, you listed, of course, the lawyer, the doctor, the eye banker, etc. So I was just laughing, but you had so many great lines. But one of the things, there were so many things, so many themes that kept coming up was, one of the things that I wanted to talk about was just this, this idea of, like, parents using Africa as, like, this boogeyman, like, sort of like, we talk about, it's in the same story that I just mentioned, Rain Check at Momokan, when Astrid's mom is, like, showing her this picture of a cousin that's like, you know, if you don't, you know, you better eat all your food because here's this hungry cousin of yours back home. And then she sort of, you know, she admits to herself that that really was like an effective weapon in her parents being able to control her. But then the what happens when she discovers that this cousin is actually living her best, flyest life on Instagram, verified and all of that. And I thought that was so hilarious. And I wonder if you want to talk about that a little bit, about the ways that, you know, our parents even sort of play into the stereotypes of back home, the old country. And you know, just talk about that a little bit.
Sure. I have to say, like, it's interesting that I have, like, you know, I think that's the strictest African parent, like, you know, and like that I have. And I must say that my parents, my mother in particular, was incredibly progressive and open and was always very supportive of us, like, you know, but of course wanted us to get our education. Because there's always that, like, you get that degree first and then you can also, you know, she was like, my brother did some modeling. It was like, just make sure you get your degree. Then these can be, you know, so I understand. I understand completely. I come from these cultures. This is not to decry or to, like, you know, or to make villainize parents' choices, because they made those choices, you know, based upon, like, the best information they had available to them at that time. Like, they came here on scholarships and educational scholarships. So of course that makes them think, hey, education is the way to go. And I still feel that way. I can't pretend like I'm going to be looking at my child side eye, you know, if they didn't want to get that degree. It's ingrained. I have to work on it. You know, it's ingrained in us. But I definitely felt like, you know, that mother in particular was like the strictest, I think, depiction of African parenthood. And but she's familiar to a lot of like my friends and familiar because of what I'm talking about, because of that, you know, this was the path to coming to America, to finding opportunities. So she is going to say, hey, like, you know, look at the opportunities that I have gotten for you, or my, you know, you and I, my father and I did this, you know, we had to walk 10 feet, you know, 10 miles or kilometers to get to school. And legitimately, those are true stories. Like my mother will tell me of stories where her mother had to, like, you know, education wasn't offered to girls at the time because, you know, it just wasn't. Like, it was a very new concept, and it came to their village, and her mother actually, you know, it was only offered to boys, and got her like a slate, like this kind of like stone slate so she could sit outside and learn. I mean, this is some amazing stuff, right? But my mother would never use it as a way to make, you know, to make me feel bad. But I thought it would be interesting to kind of like to play with that and talk with that concept, particularly because I discuss in the story the ways in which Africa is the boogeyman. It's for so many people, like, you know, like there's a zombie story that talks about boogeymen exist in Africa, folks, you know, like, oh, and then the American children, like, being told, like, you know, you better eat your broccoli, your Brussels sprouts, because children are starving in Africa, right? So, and I, you know, I'd grown up hearing nonsense like that. I'm just like, and Africa is such a huge place. I mean, it's just like, I'm like, children are starving in America, yo. You know, it's just like, children are starving in America. Children are...
Oops.
And so it's like this idea that like Africa was held up as this, like, you know, you better count your blessings because they're for the grace of God, go you, you know, to children here in America to get them to do things was something that fascinated me. So, you know, the mother using that kind of, you know, guilt trip to get her daughter in line, and, you know, just that kind of guilt, you know, like, look at all your blessings, you should be happy, you know, look what the sacrifices your father and I have made for you to be here. And yeah, parents do that. And I just wanted to, I took it to its, some might say, you know, hyperbolic extremes by showing that sometimes that is not the case, right? That, you know, that African boogeyman that you claim is there, that was being used to keep your child in line, That boogeyman might be out there, you know, living their best life and boogieing it up, in the, you know, and you don't know. So it's like this idea of this monolithic, suffering African person that is used to make sure that people here in the West, you know, are humble and delight in their life choices. It doesn't necessarily exist in the way that people think it does, you know. So.
Yeah. Well said. There is so much range. And I think, I wonder, as you were writing this, because there are, there's so many ideas of what Africa is, and many of those ideas don't come from Africans themselves, but the people who are in the power position, are the ones in the position to say, like, you know, this doesn't, you know, feel very authentic. I wonder if you, as you were writing that, if you had any of those voices in your head as you were working on this collection.
Let me parse out what you're saying. Like, so people who are in power positions saying that, would that be on the back home on the ground in Africa saying that's not authentic, or people here saying that it's inauthentic, or how do you mean?
I'm thinking of, I'm thinking more of like the actual like publication process, because, you know, to publish in the States, there are few representatives, who are, Black, let alone African. And I wonder if you, and because there are such specific ideas, and the irony is that the market is quote unquote hot for African writers right now, if you felt any sort of pressure one way or another to write certain kinds of stories or not.
Yeah, that was one of those things, like, you know, like, those ideas of authenticity, they come from everywhere, right? Like, you know, ideas of, like, you know, sometimes you self-police, like when I was looking back and thinking about African authenticity, you know, I write a lot of stories of hyphenated peoples who, you know, not, they're Cameroonian American, they're Nigerian American, you know, this from writing, you know, Ghanaian Brits. And the idea who gets to be tells authentic stories, sometimes that can come from within our own people, right? You know, sometimes our own people are saying, oh, that this is African. And I, you know, and I'm always wondering why, because we don't want the West to think we're a monolith, but sometimes because we want to gatekeep and say who gets to be authentic, we also make ourselves a monolith, you know, even within our tribes, within our own national borders. And I'm very, very, I resist that with a fiery passion. I resist any type of, you know, homogenization of us as peoples. You know, we are diverse, we contain multitudes. And that is absolutely one of the, you know, the worries I had. Like I mentioned earlier, at the time when I was, you know, like finally privileging my writing, there was a lot of stories. Africa was hot, but the kind of stories that were hot and that I would see breaking through here in the States would often be of a type, and they would have a lot of trauma. And I'm like, you know, is that the only time you guys recognize our humanity, is when somebody's pointing a gun at our heads? It was really frustrating to me. And it was one of the reasons why I was saying, man, maybe you just need to write these stories. Just write some stories where people are just like, you know, struggling to go figure out what school to go to. You know, it's, I mean, Binyabanga Wainana, when he wrote about this long ago, about how, in his satirical essay on how to write about Africa, because it's ongoing, right? Chinua Achebe wrote about this, you know, when he was in conversation with, Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness, right? This has been an ongoing issue. I'm not making this ongoing issue of people figuring out, like, you know, that one story from Africa is the African story. I mean, I'm like, one story from Cameroon is not the Cameroonian story. I'm not holding up my stories as the Cameroonian story, right? I'm not holding my stories up as the Bamley K and Awing story, which are the places my parents come from, right? I feel like we should be allowed to tell as many stories, and they should all be that authenticity measure is that they're authentic because they come from us, and these are our backgrounds, right? Not because somebody says, hey, this one doesn't have, you don't have enough jujus in it, or you don't have enough, you know, there's not enough witchcraft in this, or there's not enough starving mothers in this one or that one or the other, right? These stories all have a measure of authenticity in there. And, like, you know, anybody, I defy anybody to gatekeep, right? Everybody gets to have their say. I mean, especially like when I look at the plethora of white people's stories out there in the world, you know, the plethora, you know, I'm just like, every story, nobody gets to say what a story from, like, you know, so Philip Roth gets to tell a Jewish American story, but he's not the only Jewish American, right? We get to have the Jonathan Lathams and this Jonathan Sefer Fours and just all the Jonathans, right? So many Jonathans. So it's just like, and then we get to have, like, you know, I feel there's just, nobody does that. Nobody does that to white American stories and white Western stories and says that this one is the authentic story, right? Because there's an understanding that, you know, people are individuals and they each can tell a story that has merit and has gravitas and has meaning for some reader out there. And I feel that's all I want us to get to, that space where people understand that about our writing as well, that, like, you know, that I also resist when people read my stories and now they want to, you know, they want to feel like they went on a Cameroonian cultural safari, because I'm not the only one. I was like, I'm not the arbiter of Cameroon as well. You know, I'm telling some stories of specific what I know, right? And somebody else can tell a story about their understanding of Cameroon or understanding of being a Cameroonian in the world. So I resist that at every point, at every time. I even make a whole like joke about like the cultural safaris that people like to be taken on, you know, in one of my other stories, because that's just, you know, I never expect people to write a story about New York. And now one person's Brooklyn is all of New York for me, you know, so.
Good point. I wonder, speaking of, what is your favorite story in the collection?
Oh my goodness. People, I just got asked this. Nana Akua Brookhammond. I got to see this. I am not going to, that is so Sophie's Choice for me. I love these stories all in so many different ways. I think I just got asked this question 2 days ago. And what I said was like, you know, sometimes you have favorites because one story is getting on your nerves and you're just like a bad child. It's just like, you know, I wish that child would just stop yelling and everything like that. So I go through those phases, but I honestly, like, I don't have any filler stories. I don't have stories which I was just like, yeah, I didn't do a good job. I hate that story. Yeah. You know, her head kind of oblong, but she looked like her daddy, you know, like that. I don't have any stories like that. You know, I really do. I feel very happy in this collection that I told stories that I was interested in telling, that I tried new voices. I tried, you know, there's everything in there. Like I tried genres, I tried voices, I tried, you know, different modalities. There's ekphrastic stories with imagery in there. I feel very happy and centered in that I did that. So there's not a story where I was like, well, you know, I just wrote that because, you know, they said I should have to try that kind of story. No. And yeah, so I would say that, you know, some of them get on my nerves. Like I know for a while, like it just, it takes a village I was like, oh, there was a time when I'd only written the first part, Our Girl, and Their Girl was written like a year later. And that voice was very insistent. And I was like, why won't this voice stop messing with me? I don't feel like writing right now. And like that character's voice was very insistent. And she's just like she is on the page. And she's just like an Uzi, you better write me. You know, you can't just tell. So I was just like, okay, let me just go ahead and take care and write this baby's kid butt story, you know? So that's what kind of happened. So, but I still love her. I love her. And then I love her insistency. And I love her, like, you know, her ballsiness and brashness, you know. So at that time I was like, you know, doing something else, and I was just like, I'm working on this over here, can you stop bothering me, kind of just like that, like that child that wants to tug on your mama's, like, you know, lobe string, like, you know, it's like you just really don't want to be bothered, but it is what it is. And now I love her just like the rest of the kids.
Oh, that's, you know, I love
talking
that
about that. I like to ask, can you tell listeners when a character you created suddenly comes to life, just as you just described? When do you realize that this is what's just happened?
Yeah, for me, it's always the voice. And that's why I say it sounds almost like I'm being possessed, because it really is like the voice of a character and a narrator comes to me, and then it's insistent. I mean, I have a very, like, as you can see, specific speaking style. I'm a Capricorn, so my mind is always busy. I'm always thinking about different things. And like, you know, so it's typically when a voice is so insistent and it's so interesting to me that I start writing like the first paragraph. And once that first paragraph is on the page, then that's pretty much what I would say 99% of the stories, the first paragraph is as you see it. It's the same paragraph that I started with, because the voices, if I don't have that down, if that's not consistent in my head, I don't know what the story is going to be about yet. I don't know where they're going to take me, but they're just like, as I described to somebody who was saying, like meeting somebody on the train who's really interesting, or a contour, and they're saying something to you, like, they're like, girl, do you know? And you're just like, ooh, tell me more. You know, it happens just like that. If it's not happening like that, then I'm bored, I start drifting off, my eyes start like rolling, you know, so it has to be that way. And I think that's why my first paragraphs always feel so punchy and so full of something, because it happens to me the same way. I have to be interested, I have to be invested. And that's how stories have unfold for me. And of course you have all these other things that you've been thinking about, like, oh, maybe one day I'll write a story about, like, you know, Comic-Con, but all these little things, because, you know, you live and have life experiences. I've been to Comic-Con, I've done cosplay, you know, you have these life experiences. I've been in those African charismatic churches. I've been in these spaces, you know, some places that you're just interested in. You think you want to write about them someday, but you're not necessarily, like, you know, wedded to them on, and I'm not wedded to writing about them until a voice comes to me or something comes to me that says, oh, that is my story. You know, that little, you know, that little experience you had at Comic-Con how many years ago, you know, that was actually part of my story. You didn't know you went there so that you could help me tell my story. And that's what happens. So.
All right. So would you like to read a little bit from maybe Schoolyard Cannibal or Night Becomes Us?
Okay.
So listeners, sure. Get a little flavor of what we're discussing here.
This is hilarious because the two stories that you're talking about, I did not open. You're going to do that to me because I was like, okay, now I have a text ability to say, okay, so let me
see. No, you can read anything. Anything you read is going to be good.
All right. So,
I mean, I found Night Becomes Us so interesting because, and I agree with Nana Ekua, you have this ability to switch scenes and use humor in a very effective way. So when you're talking about Zainab in Night Becomes Us, Zainab has been here for 6 months. She's working as a washroom attendant at this nightclub. She comes from a sort of conservative Muslim background. And she sees all these young ladies coming into the washroom dressed in very, you know, sexy outfit. And sometimes she peeks onto the dance floor. And whenever the washroom is empty, she also starts dancing, right? Alone. She's young, so she likes dancing. So she's dancing with her eyes closed. And then she opens her eyes and there's another lady in the washroom. So we're thinking, wow, this is a very conservative lady. This must be a very shocking experience for her. But then you take her back, and then we learn that she's actually a person who survived a suicide bombing that killed her mother. And the ability to transport the reader from this washroom scene to that explosion, I just found so powerful and amazing. Mm. So maybe you want to talk a little bit about that?
Okay, sure. It's interesting to me that that juxtaposition, like, you know, of like, you know, of pathos and levity. I mean, I think that's how we sometimes we get through life, right? Like, I think they say that comedy is pain plus time, right? Like, you know, as when you further remove yourself from the pain, you can start to find moments of, you know, strangeness or not necessarily joy, but like a moment of levity in it. And I think that I often use, I don't like to be pedantic, so I often use that kind of satirical tone or that levity to kind of help people understand or educate people. So that's something that I do often and throughout the book, and that's just naturally me. So it's not necessarily something I didn't mean to do that, but I find the interesting, you know, when you're in this kind of spaces like the nightclub, and I saw an African washroom attendant, and I was like, I'd never seen an African woman washroom attendant in those spaces. So I just started thinking about her story, you know, and what might have brought her there. All right, so let me see. I will read from, you talked about a specific space in this story. I'm wondering whether I should read from that section where she's meeting that young girl.
Well, as I said, you can read anything.
All right, so I will read from the beginning then, because I feel like sometimes it's easier for people to get into the beginning. Night veils and reveals her dark face charted up with stars, neon lit, flossing. In alleys, on corners, Night veils and reveals her dark face charted up with stars, neon lit, flossing. In alleys, on corners, users parlay with pushers, John's politic with pimps, haggling for discount strange. Hip-hop and synth-pop coat the stained glass windows of Cream, NYC's hottest new club, a deconsecrated church where bouncers in muscle tees play St. Peter at the Pearlies. Access granted or denied. Zainab, The ladies' room attendant sees none of this from her perch on a high stool in the bathroom. Its inky, lacquered black licorice walls shine like mirrors, yet reflect nothing. But it is her job to see, to be ever vigilant in attending to others. She offers a paper napkin, then a shoulder to lean on to a teary-eyed girl mumbling about that motherfucker who thinks he is. The aforementioned motherfucker is in the VIP stash, blitzed on Ace of Spades, grinding on some shorty's fatty. At 3 a.m., he will wake up groggy, cuffed up to a bedpost, remembering his girlfriend, his ex now probably, has slapped him on the dance floor, then stormed off to God knows where. Christ. Zainab is holding said girlfriend's hair back, a lace front weave unlacing in the steamy bathroom as the girl dry heaves into the sink. Preoccupied, she fails to see the woman in the purple sequin mini dress stealing a fresh pack of spearmint and $28 of her hard-earned tips from the countertop, her dream fund money. Zainab had purchased everything on offer herself, the candy and gum, mouthwash and mints, the combs, hair gel, scrunchies, safety pins, tampons, band-aids, Kleenex, lip gloss, snacks, snack stains, stain sticks, a lint brush, aspirin, and antacids. Her tip jar is full to bursting with crumpled bills pulled from bras and teeny bedazzled clutches. She is well-paid and well-regarded for her insightful attentions, her crazy glue fix-its for broken stilettos, plastic slippers ready should the bootleg shoe surgery go bust. There is lotion on hand, redolent of water lilies and lemongrass. An Apple TV air freshener she spritzes in each stall. A crystal garden of fragrances. Designer perfumes and vintage atomizers sourced at the variety store off the subway stop in her hood.
All right, so just give us like a sampling to that suicide bombing scene then, because then I want you to transport the listener.
Okay.
Just a bit of that from the Boko Haram suicide bomber. And the bomber was also a girl, a teenage girl.
Yes, Hanifa. Back in Cameroon, there were curfews for the nighttime, cautionary tales of headstrong girls who had followed the wrong men into the darkness. But your anxious school teachers and aunties and the errant shopkeeper never warned you of the dangers lurking in broad daylight. On a bright sunny day, holding her mother's hand as they bought food to celebrate her 16th birthday, Zainab and her mother, Mariama, were blown up. A 16-year-old girl named Hanifa detonated a suicide bomb not 10 yards from where they stood buying tomatoes. Mariama was thinking of her husband's dinner. She was humming a pop song her daughter teased her for knowing, while examining sun-ripened tomatoes, some pocked with black carbuncles. Her daughter's hip bumped this table, toppling a cavalcade of red that went rolling and rolling and rolling into the dust till hitting the knees of a girl about her daughter's age, kneeling in the dirt. The girl's hijab had fallen back from her face to reveal a head of unkempt and uneven cornrowed hair. Mariama clucked her tongue in sympathy. Her last thoughts before she saw what was cradled in the girl's lap, before comprehension curdled a scream in the base of her throat, she thought to herself, where is that poor child's mother?
Yep, that is an amazing ability. Back to you, Nanekwa. And we have about 5 minutes left.
Yeah, I love that story too. That was, it just took me back to, you know, going to the club and the check-in attendant and just sort of wanting to know, like, what's this person's story? Right. And it was when they sort of, you know, exit the place, and then just sort of her connecting with sort of like her big brother figure, as well as her love interest or romantic interest was really tender. And I think there's a line in that story that I really liked when you talk about the fact that she basically, that sort of big brother figure says to her, like, you know, watch out for the men and, you know, focus on the women. And then she says to herself, we are not as sweet as you believe, my cousin. And I loved that because it's so true. It's sort of like, and then, you know, obviously she gets robbed by the woman in the sequins dress. But just, I think that's something that you do throughout the story is really sort of twist the idea of, like, you know, what we see on its face is there's so much more going on under the surface. And so I think that's what you do so powerfully in all of the stories that, I really enjoyed.
Thank you. It's really important to me, like, to show women. I mean, I was talked about showing Africa identity in all its multiplicity and its, you know, its nuance. And I think that, you know, that holds double for women in particular. I feel like, you know, there are these assigned roles and prescribed roles for womanhood in society. You know, are we likable? Are we marriageable? You know, are we this, you know, are we good mothers, you know? And I wanted to kind of, every time I write a woman, a female character, I'm always like, you know, looking for those moments to show her other aspects of her, who she is. You know, we have, and I mean, we do so many things. You know, we contain those multitudes I talked about so beautifully, right? We are hashtag mom power, hashtag girl power, hashtag squad. You know, we're friends, we're lovers, we're mothers, we're worker bees, you know, but it's something that I wanted to have even those quiet spaces. Who are we? Who do we allow ourselves to be when we're, you know, we come home at night? I always want to kind of explore that, you know, when we have to, you know, and those things are not even masks. Like, I can't even say we're wearing the mask because they're just intrinsic to who we are, but there's so much more in terms of our, you know, of who we are, that I just want to explore as many times as possible as I can on the page.
All right, so we run out of time. First, you, Nana Nkweti, maybe you can tell us the meaning also of the title, Walking on Cowrie Shells, for listeners that may not be familiar, but also tell listeners how they can get in touch with you if they want to continue the conversation, or give out your website or your email address if you want. And let us know if one day in the future we'll see you at a live New York reading. And then after you, Nana Ekua, tell listeners also how they can get in touch with you. Mention your website.
Thank you so much for having me here today, Milton. This has been truly a pleasure talking to you and Nana Ekua Bu-Hammond. Readers interested in reading this book, or, you know, are contacting me and learning more about the work I do in the world, can visit www.nananketi.com. That's www.nananketi.com. The story that brought Walking on Cowrie Shells title to life is the final story, Kings, in the collection. And I'm talking about, like, that interesting space that I often talk about in the book, this liminal space of trying to be, you know, everything and trying to everyone, and somehow feeling like you're not getting it quite right. I think that's a very human space to be in. You feel like you're walking on eggshells, like around certain people, certain places. And I just switched it up and changed it to Walking on Cowrie Shells, because cowrie shells, of course, you know, is emblematic of the continent. Cowrie shells are a currency. They denoted so many things back home. So Walking on Cowrie Shells is my metaphor for saying that, you know, and sometimes in life, we don't know necessarily where we're supposed to be, who we're supposed to be. You know, we walk on these cowrie shells, but we're going to still walk forward and walk with purpose.
And Nana Ekua?
Yes. Well, I just want to say congratulations, Nana Nkweti. I love being a fellow Nana on this platform with you. I love it, the two Nanas. Congratulations again. And I look forward to just reading more of your work. This was just such a lovely, 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 lovely introduction to you. You can find me, anyone who's interested in following me can find me at www.nanabrewhammond.com. So it's NANAB as in boy, REWHAMMOND.com.
So listeners, you've now heard this, wonderful conversation we've been having with our guest, Nana Nkweti, the author of Walking on Cowrie Shells. And joining me today in the conversation is Nanaikwa Bruhammond, who is also an author. And we'll be discussing her books in a future conversation. Today, we're looking at Nanaikwa's writing. You've heard a sampling of her reading from the book. And I must tell you, and this is without any bias, it's a book that I enjoy tremendously in reading it for preparation for today's conversation. And the publisher, Grey Wolf, has contributed two copies. And we will send a copy to two of the highest bidders. In that way, we'll be able to raise some money to help support WBAI and its programming. So if you're able to dig a little deeper today, please do call 212-209-2950 and tell us what you're contributing for a copy of Walking on Cowrie Shells. And at the end of the day, we will see who the two highest bidders are. And as I said earlier, that does not mean the rest of you cannot just call and offer your regular contribution to support WBAI. And you can also do so by dialing 212-209-2950. And then, of course, you can adopt one of our shows, one of our programs. And as always, I hope Black Star News Show is one of the programs you decide to adopt as a buddy, in which case the money is taken out of your credit or debit card on a monthly basis. You can do so by going to give, and then the number 2, and then WBAI.org. All right. Thank you, folks. Listeners, remember also to visit BlackStarNews.com, and you can follow me at Ali Mahdi on Twitter. Thanks to both of our guests. Remain Pan-African, and see you next week, listeners.
WPFW in Washington and WBAI in New York, I'm Amara Evering with some brief news headlines. Today, the Supreme Court ruled that the government can indefinitely detain certain immigrants who say they will face persecution or torture if they are deported to their native countries. The court also ruled that immigrants are not entitled to a hearing about whether they should be released while the government evaluates their claims. The court held a 6-3 ruling, meaning that three judges were in dissent. Conservative Justice Samuel Alito wrote on this decision saying, quote, "Those aliens are not entitled to a bond hearing." Justice Stephen Breyer, however, wrote in the dissent, quote, "But why would Congress want to deny a bond hearing to an individual who reasonably fears prosecution or torture and who, as a result, faces proceedings that may last for many months or even years?" And yesterday, the Supreme Court decided not to take up the issue of whether the nation's schools must allow students to use the bathroom that matches their gender identities. The court declined to hear the case of Gavin Grimm, the transgender student who challenged a Virginia school board policy that restrooms are, quote, "limited to the corresponding biological genders." Lower courts sided with Grimm that this violated Title IX, the civil rights law against sex discrimination, and since the Supreme Court isn't taking up the case, his win will stay in place. 25 congressional leaders and a media advocacy group are urging the Federal Communications Commission to examine how policy decisions and programs have harmed Black Americans and other communities of color, according to a letter sent today to the acting FCC chair. The FCC is an independent governmental agency that is responsible for regulating communications by radio, television, wire, satellite, and cable. Media advocates and experts have been concerned about a lack of diversity and representation in media and argue that racism permeates things like news coverage. In the letter, it says, quote, "Although many journalists and artists of color have used their talents to ensure critical stories about their communities are being told, our nation's big media companies nevertheless continue to stereotypically depict people of color as being a threat or burden to society." Dozens of climate activists were arrested yesterday in a nonviolent protest in front of the White House, demanding that President Biden take meaningful action on the climate crisis. Members of the Sunrise Movement are calling on Biden and congressional Democrats to pass an infrastructure bill that includes major investments to green energy, including a fully funded civilian climate corps. Among the protesters was Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who said that a lot of legislators, quote, "don't understand that while this may be the hottest summer of their lives, it's going to be one of the coolest summers of our lives. And so what that means is that they brought this heat on us, so we bring the heat on them."